Welcome. Come right in. You can't afford to miss this.
Step right up.
Natural disasters, and eventually the end of the world.
All right, good news. Broadcasting from the beautiful Tenderloin in downtown San Francisco, it's the Are You Serious Show. I'm Are You Serious, and this is my show. The Are You Serious Show is, of course, the flagship show of the brand spanking new Mondo Globo Radio Network. Today I'll be talking to one of my favorite authors and a very good friend of mine, Eric Davis, about a new book he has out about the fourth Led Zeppelin album. That's the Led Zeppelin album with the picture of the old man hunched over carrying a basket of wheat on the cover. That's wheat, not weed, by the way. And it's a very mysterious cover for a very mysterious, nameless Led Zeppelin album. Yes, a whole book about one Led Zeppelin album. And we'll be talking to Eric Davis in just a few minutes. But first, we'll be talking about some things that have been going on in our world.
Are you serious?
We're here talking with our friends, Elena Corral.
Hi.
Hi. Steve Robles and
Hola.
Jeff Deal. Everybody Hola. Say hi. Okay.
Hey.
Good. And so what's on your mind, Elena?
Okay, well, I don't have anything nearly as intense as Led Zeppelin, but it's pretty funny. I was surfing the internet, and I do that a lot, and saw this kind of thing that's going on in Mesa, Arizona, where the police department is requesting $100,000 in federal grant money to train a capuchin monkey for its SWAT team.
Awesome.
And then upon further...
How much money?
$100,000. And then upon further surfing, I saw it was on Al Jazeera's website. And they're laughing at us because they're going, what the hell are these people doing? Yeah, a capuchin monkey.
Well, I personally won't be happy, and I don't care how much money they spend on it. I won't be happy until most security forces are simian in nature. I think
well,
an all-monkey
hey.
Police force is where we need to go in this society.
I think evolution is going in that direction anyway.
In fact, I think most monkeys, well, never mind. I won't talk about cops that way, but.
Talk about cops any way you like. This is an FDA.
I think the average trained monkey is a little bit more on the brighter end of the bulb spectrum than.
So $100,000 to train a monkey.
To train a monkey. That's right. A capuchin monkey. Those are the ones that have been trained for service monkeys, for quadriplegics, because they've got.
I wonder why it takes $100,000 to train one of them. What where does that money go? And what
union, the union.
I think
that's
80.
Probably,
yeah. I think
yeah.
80,000 of it goes to training
union.
The monkey not to jerk itself off in public.
True, or throw shit at people.
Yeah, throw feces at
now,
people.
Now this would keep the terrorists out of the country.
Yes, and in fact,
the monkeys.
And how are they
going to
keep
the airport,
monkey from
feces?
Losing control and grabbing a gun and just kind of you know.
Well, what? How do you
going
keep most
shit.
Monkeys
no
that are
intended.
Already trained in law enforcement from grabbing a gun and losing control?
And
plus, I think forget terrorism. Let's just talk about local enforcement. I think
monkeys would do a good job on drunk driving.
Yeah,
and so
I think
forth.
Getting feces, monkey feces thrown at you could be a great deterrent.
I think it would make a great cartoon.
I think that's worse
capuchin
than going
monkey,
to jail.
Swat
actually,
monkey.
I really think
some people would stop. Doing certain things if they thought the monkeys were going to throw their shit at them. Actually.
SWAT monkey.
Huh.
Yeah, I wouldn't personally stop doing any of the illegal stuff that I do, but I could imagine
smoke some of that shit.
I think I might do more just just the hopes that the monkey would throw shit at someone else.
Yeah.
I'd want the monkey to come at me. Yeah. They're going to put a little Kevlar you know, vest on the monkey and send him in with a two-way radio so that they can tell him what to do so he can go in and unlock doors.
I see. So the monkey is sort of
a little cam on his head,
like what they want to use robots for eventually.
Exactly.
Well, yeah,
they want to use a monkey in place of a robot.
Yeah, right. As a matter of fact, Adam Weishaupt to the side, and I
Adam
know
Weishaupt.
A guy. It's true. He is well is
the head of the Illuminati.
Part of the SS, but. We don't talk about that too much. But we know a guy who's working for, what, Caltech?
Yeah.
Yeah, Caltech. What?
He's going to NYU soon.
Anyway, he's working on cybernetic technology to control monkeys.
Heard something about this.
Basically make monkeys like robots that'll do what you want them to. And in exchange, of course, and this is where the masturbation problem comes in. They spend a lot of, like, there's some monkeys that you can't really work with because of their masturbation problem.
Well, shouldn't they have some kind of aversion drug that they could give to the monkeys or some technique to keep the monkeys from reaching?
No, because that would be cruel.
Chemical castration.
On the other hand, it's cool to open up the monkey's brain and put a bunch of electrodes in it and like.
Yeah, we all want to have electrodes in our brain.
And it gets juicy juice when it gets the when it does what it's supposed to.
Well, and they started. I mean, they're controlling rats. Actually, they've been very successful at controlling the movements of rats.
And rats are much less of a problem when they masturbate. I mean, there's really nothing
rats masturbated.
I don't know that they do, and that could be like what makes them so easy to train.
Do they have the same puzzle solving skills that the monkeys do?
Maybe they should use
I don't know
mice.
But rats don't really hold up in combat so well.
So I mean, did they mention, are they doing any technological hacks on the monkeys, or just using straight up?
No, they're just going to
straight up.
Well, that part of where the money will go. They're saying it'll take about $85,000 in grant money to outfit the monkey in the gear, which is the two-way camera, little movie camera. I mean, the two-way radio movie camera, its own bulletproof vest, because God forbid the monkey get shot, and then to pay for veterinary care, food, and habitat for 3 years, because they think it'll take 3 years to train the monkey.
Yes, and you also have to hire Ricardo Montalban to train the monkey, because anybody who has seen the Planet of the Apes films knows that nobody trains a monkey like Ricardo Montalban.
Yes, and it's better to look good than to feel good.
Available to us?
Yes. Available to us is...
Driving a Cordova.
Oh, well, I mean, the guy's still living off the con royalties. Are you kidding?
Wow, so this is true Fantasy Island. So we're here in the studio with Eric Davis, a good friend and one of my favorite writers. And as I said earlier, he has written a marvelous book about a single album. The fourth Led Zeppelin album, a mysterious record with no particular title, although some people call it Zoso. And Eric is going to give us a little reading from the book, and then we're going to talk.
All right, thanks, Ken. The whole sort of setup for the book is that it starts sort of with my obsession with Led Zeppelin when I was a teenager, which is, I think, when a lot of people become obsessed with Led Zeppelin. And I was just trying to reflect a little bit on what attracted to me at the time. Led Zeppelin knew something, but they weren't fessing. If only I could decode those four notorious signals. If only I could turn the idiotic wheel on the cover of Led Zeppelin 3 in just the right way. Then these mysterious figures would tell their tales. The Queen of Light, the Keepers of the Gloom, the Black Dog, the guy named Roy Harper. Then I'd know who was going to receive that nude girl child held aloft inside the gatefold of Houses of the Holy. The born-again surfers in my typing class knew Satan. And while I wasn't ready to go that far, it wasn't clear to me then or now which side of the force made Zeppelin's majesty. Sure, Robert Plant seemed more like a randy hippie pretty boy than a servant of the pit. But Jimmy Page, obsessed with the willfully scandalous occultist Aleister Crowley, was another story. Posters on my wall showed Page immersed in what Bowie called Crowley's uniform of imagery. The silk threads emblazoned with poppies and MAGA stars, the SS cap, the slit puffy eyelids that lent his face a stoned orientalism, the Les Paul slung so low it seemed plugged into the Muladhara chakra where the kundalini coils, this was not a wholesome man.
Thank you. So this is a pretty unusual thing for somebody to do a very intelligent reading of the sort of hermetic occult message behind Led Zeppelin. They're not generally taken enormously seriously as one of the more intellectual rock bands, perhaps because of Robert Plant's lyrics. Do you want to speak a little bit to that?
Sure. I mean, it's part of the fun of doing the book was because there's really very little written about Zeppelin that take them at all seriously outside of fan bios and fan sites online. And so part of the pleasure of the book was just to see how far I could take it, because one of my feelings is when you start invoking mystery, the sort of sense of the sublime or the sacred or some kind of mysterious occult energy, that it becomes an interactive thing where it's not just about what the band's doing, it's also about what you're imagining. That's a lot about what makes the occult appealing. So in a way, it was almost to see how I could take this record and how deeply I could go in trying to find out these meanings. But as is often the case with the occult, the deeper you go, connections start to happen and interesting things start to come together. So it actually came through really impressively in my experience, just how many odd little tidbits really started to fit together, because they do have a tremendous emotional, dreamlike power. And just the fact that, you know, that's one of the first things you learn about the band when you're learning about them, is that, you know, Jimmy Page was into this, was into Aleister Crowley, or even more, that they had all like sold their souls to the devil. Like, that's one of the myths you hear when you're in high school. And it's like, well, what's behind that? What does it mean to like have something that has that kind of charge? And how can you read it through this piece of music?
Can I just say something? I had no idea that this album didn't have a name. No idea at all. I mean, I remember seeing this cover. I remember the music. I had no idea. It didn't have a name.
It either doesn't have a name or it has many names.
I didn't know that.
It doesn't have an official name, but it's interesting how many names have been assigned to it by... For me, it's always been commonly referred to as Zeppelin 4.
Or Zoso. Say something about the mystery of the name in connection to...
Sure. Well, I mean, in a way, the namelessness of the record is kind of what I'm talking about mystery. Like, it's how do you make this major, you know, multi-million dollar selling record, like totally heart of the pop
with
commodity
the
world, that has no name. And what does that do? It's a very aggressive way of saying we have mystique, we have mystery. You can't know us all the way.
And to clarify, it doesn't have the name Led Zeppelin on the cover,
right,
which is different from the Beatles' White Album, where they
exactly at least
have
there's
the name.
No name, and there's the label doesn't have a name, so it's this weird weird object, and it sort of reflects the way that they were able to, in the midst of like the heart of like huge culture industry, you know, right in the mainstream of it, to do something that creates a sense of mystery and kind of almost you have to go into it to figure out what's going on with it. What are these weird little squiggles on the side? Well, maybe that's a word, Zoso. Maybe it's a word. According to Page, it's not even a word.
How much of the mystery do you attribute also to the fact that it was pre-video and that music back then was dealing with the imagination a little bit more? You didn't always know exactly what they looked like, except certain very staged photos or, you know, album covers, basically.
Well, it's a great question, but it's even more than just the absence of the images that sort of take down mystery, because there's not as much for you to imagine. It's that their music in particular, and this is where I think they were an extremely sophisticated band, I think, in the sense that their intellectual content lies in their production more than anything else. And Page is at least as good a producer as he is a guitarist. And that in particular... their songs, in particular the more ballad songs, are all about creating a sense of space where the imagination is kind of drawn up. Like, you move through their records the way you move through a landscape. And mm-hmm. Prince has talked about this. He wants to make a record where every song is like a new little world you go through. And that was something they did with the materials of production. And it partly calls up the sense of the imagination. So when you're a kid or you're smoking pot or whatever, it's like it's a whole world that's swallowing you up in a way that nobody was doing at that time, with the exception of a few psychedelic bands.
I always found Page's music to be very architectural. And I think maybe one of the clues to why people don't take the band as seriously intellectually is that the great genius of the band really is Jimmy Page and not the lyricist.
Very much so. And that's where the intelligence lies. And that's part of the whole mystique around Jimmy Page, is that he's this kind of hidden architect. And that sort of calls up this sense of like, well, what is he actually doing? What is he trying to do with this music? And so all of the lunchroom rumors about the selling his soul and all that is kind of it responds to a little bit of a sense of like, where is this power coming from? Where is the power of this music coming from? Who's designing it? Who's making it happen?
How much of the lyrics were written by Plant versus Page.
Pretty much all Plant.
The official line is that Plant basically writes
except
all the lyrics.
Except for the first record, Jimmy Page wrote, I think, the lyrics to much of the, maybe all of them but one. But after, I think, by the time they got to Led Zeppelin III.
Let's hear a little bit of something that comes through Led Zeppelin, and we'll be back in a couple of minutes.
Are you serious?
question.
We're back with Eric Davis talking about the mysterious Led Zeppelin, quote, four, quote, unquote, album. By the way, this book is published by Continuum, a series called 33 and a Third, a bunch of books written about mostly classic rock albums. And a lot of the occult mystery around Zep comes through the relationship that's known between Jimmy Page and his fascination with Aleister Crowley, and him being a collector of Crowley and buying a house where Crowley did a bunch of his magical workings. And of course, Crowley called himself the Great Beast, and some people call him a Satanist, some people don't. Talk a little bit about how important Crowley is to the Led Zeppelin working.
Sure, sure. You know, in investigating, you know, what makes this music work, what makes the mystery work, is there really a deeper kind of occult sort of exploration going on here? You got to look at, like, what are the facts on the ground? What do we actually know about Page? Because he's a very mysterious cat, doesn't review much in interviews. A few interviews, he'll talk about going to seances or being interested in magic, and he'll mention Aleister Crowley on a few occasions. But he basically keeps his, you know, tarot cards close to his chest. But we do know that he was a big collector of Crowley's, probably the first or second most, you know, sort of leading collector. Lived in his mansion near Loch Ness. But, you know, it opened a bookshop in the early 70s called the Equinox, which was the name of the sort of house organ of Aleister Crowley's Magical Society. So he was clearly very in tune with the very specific vibration of Crowley. And if you're sort of interested in what Crowley's on about using magic as a way to sort of create reality, create your experience, explore your experience, a tremendous emphasis on the will, a tremendous emphasis on kind of making things up as you go along, not staying stuck in existing metaphors or whatever. It's really hard to imagine that Jimmy Page didn't start doing things, but we don't know that. We don't know what he did. He might have just been a collector geek supreme. But to my mind, it suggests that there's some deeper stuff going on.
Yeah. This current runs through on a lot of rock and roll. I mean, there's a lot of reference to Aleister Crowley. We know that the Rolling Stones spent some time hanging out with Kenneth Anger, infamous Crowleyite.
Page also had some kind of relationship with Anger, I know, during the 70s, but I don't believe, I don't know how much you know about this. I remember reading about it in Cream when I was about 15 mm-hmm. years old. They tried to get together on some project, and there was some kind of falling out.
Well, yeah, that's basically it. Page was making the soundtrack for Anger's sort of great work, Lucifer Rising, and he made about 20 minutes of the soundtrack. And basically, even though, you know, Kenneth Anger had the most famous rock star in the 70s, like, working for him free and letting him use his basement, he got sick of Page's sort of lackadaisical efforts and essentially, you know, fired him and got really, whatever, he got cranky about him. So those tapes do exist. It's kind of interesting music. The opening of In the Evening from In Through the Outdoor mm-hmm. is sounds that are very much like what he was doing, more experimental kind of washes of sound, kind of dark, seething effects that Page was working on. And so that's another sign that he's clearly, you know, sort of in the territory. And I think it makes it worth asking, what would it mean for this music itself to be enchanted on some level, even though we never really know what's going on.
Okay, I have a really lame but burning question, nonetheless. Did they not give this album a name purposely to create additional allure, if you will, or had they just run out of names by their fourth album?
No, there's a specific story they have, which is that when Led Zeppelin III came out, it was slagged by the critics. So most of the critics did not treat Led Zeppelin kindly, and they really did not treat their third record, which is one of their best, very kindly at all. And so almost as a kind of petulant act, they refused to put anything on it. But it was also, I believe, a way for them to express the power in the relationship with the record company. One of the things that marks Led Zeppelin, and in this they are sort of, running in an oddly parallel way with the Grateful Dead, in that they were one of the first acts to really wrest control away from the record company. The Dead did it by just starting their own record company. Led Zeppelin still stayed with the relationship with Atlantic, but they really demanded a huge amount of control, not
and
only
they just
over
said,
the product.
Here's the album, No Name.
Yeah, yeah, and that was a big fight. So it was also a way for them to just kind of do what they willed.
It helped the fact that they had like a 500-pound ex-pro wrestler as their manager. When you talk about wresting some of that control away, some of it was literally in a way that almost presaged Suge Knight was literally physically wrested away on behalf of the band by their giant violent manager. And that leads me to we were talking earlier about the vacuum of books that have been written about Zeppelin, and I wonder if you think that has something to do with the notoriety of Hammer of the Gods. And the book itself was fascinating reading, but at the same time has been, I mean, obviously the band is going to refute, you know, mud shark stories and things like that, but its notoriety isn't necessarily tied to any assumption of accuracy. And right. I wonder what your thoughts are about
well,
that.
Well, I mean, it's appropriate that probably the most scandalous and fun to read band bio from the time is about this particular band, because in a way they were the most scandalous. They seemed to be the most heinous with or exuberant with groupies, however you want to see it. And in addition to that, you know, the groupies are one thing, but they were also extremely violent. They, as a large, or as taking the organization as one, you know, one, which is not really fair. John Bonham was certainly capable of extreme violence, and so was Peter Grant, the manager, and some of the roadies they were associated with. So they had a legitimate reputation as being a sort of marauding band. So they were kind of playing out their myth, and at the same time, I believe, also kind of invoking a kind of dangerous energy that sort of, you know, goes into the music in an almost magical way, the same way that a music can invoke sexual energy and then kind of take it and take it somewhere else, and that's part of what you're responding to. They invoked a kind of violence as well. Whole Lot of Love is a very violent song.
Speaking of books about Led Zeppelin, one of the reference points in your book is another huge, apparently huge book written by a former Led Zeppelin fan who became a Christian. And there's some very amusing passages in there. You want to speak to that for me?
Well, yeah, that really was probably what made my book so fun to write. And in a way, he did some of my homework for me, because he became obsessed with this idea that they really were fully satanic, which I don't really know what it means. And even if Page was totally into Crowley, he wasn't a Satanist in the way that this fellow believes. But he just goes for it in over 650 self-published pages, diving into every little potential meaning of every lyric, going completely paranoiac in all the connections that he makes. And yet, in some sense, he does some really interesting work, because he shows how deep some of the connections, some of the words, some of the lyrics, some of the music can go, and that there is a kind of enchantment with it. It's just that he always thinks it boils down to this very typical story of satanic control.
How do you think the backward masking scandal of the 80s on, you know, on by the televangelists helped to sort of sustain their mystery during a period where they weren't, you know, doing anything creatively?
Yeah, it was amazing. I mean, if they couldn't have designed it better themselves, really. But it's no accident in a way. I mean, part of what I'm saying is that it's not just that they were able to make mystery and enchantment, but they were able to take mystery and enchantment and put it onto physical pieces of plastic that you would go buy. So it's there is a magic, but it's the magic of the actual object. And part of the appeal of this album is it has no name. The actual thing you're holding, you're like, what is this? It's sort of strange. It's odd. And at the same time, it's a totally mass-produced item. So the fact that the televangelists could then take these very same pieces of plastic and create even more peculiar mystery out of them is just totally, it's almost like if you were going to write a story about the most satanic band in the 70s, that's how it would have to end. And of course, it did sustain, you know, it did sustain them. It did give them a shot in the arm. And those samples are strange if you listen to them. They're uncanny, let's put it that way.
Well, I think that's a good way to end this session. The most satanic band of the century, Led Zeppelin. We will be back.
We'll get you for that, Ken.
Yeah, they're coming.
I always thought after me. I always thought Toto was the most satanic band.
My impression is the less satanic, the more satanic. But we'll be back with Eric Davis at a future date to talk more about Led Zeppelin.
Are you serious?
I want to thank you all for sticking with us for our second show. I want to thank Eric Davis for coming in and the great Gang of Four staff here for joining in on all the nonsense. And I want to tell you people that if you want to get in touch with me and tell me what's great or bad or horrible or wonderful about this show, you can write to me at areyousirious@well.com. R-U-S-I-R-I-U-S at well.com. And I want to hear from people if whether they'd like this show to be a little longer. We would like to do an hour-long show. And we know that people will possibly have to download multiple files in order to listen to a longer show. But we think this would work as a longer program, and I'd like to hear from people as to what they think about that. So, once again, thanks, and don't be afraid of the dark. Some people would stop doing certain things if they thought the monkeys were going to throw their shit at them.